Good afternoon, folks. We're going to call the Conference Committee on Jobs and Energy to order. We have a few testifiers. We have some other things. There's an agenda here for us, but I don't think you guys got it, which that's fine. Just so long as we pretend we know what we're doing. So with that, we have some people who are going to present to us today. I'm going to hand this over to Chair Wagenius, and let her take care of it because she made all the arrangements. So there you go. But I will say this: we're likely to take a recess at 5, and or 5:30. What time are you coming back?
5:30.
So sometime before 5:30, we'll recess for an hour and a half or thereabouts. Go ahead, Jean.
Thank you, Chair Mahoney. As I said, there's an agenda in the packet, and we're starting with comments from some in the business community. And I am hoping that the business community can be a bridge between the House and the Senate as we move forward. We welcome Paul Douglas, a nationally respected meteorologist with 40 years of broadcast television and radio experience, and an entrepreneur working with Arius Weather and Predictus. He's going to talk to us about trends. He needs to get back to Minneapolis for his show this afternoon, so he only has about 20 minutes to talk with us, and so he won't be taking questions. However, he is going to provide an opportunity for written questions, and our committee administrator, Mike Molzan, will organize any questions that members have and get them to Mr. Douglas. With that, welcome to the House and Senate Conference Committee.
Thank you, Representative. It's an honor to be here. Thank you for inviting me to come and share my thoughts and some of the data, some of the trends that made me do a double take as a scientist over the years. And I should point out that my acknowledgement that the climate is changing was not an overnight epiphany, and it had nothing to do with Al Gore. It had everything to do with paying attention and trying to connect the dots, and frankly reacting to the weather and perceived changes in the patterns. And I give a lot of talks. I talk to farmers. I talk to sportsmen. Lately, I've been talking to a lot of churches around the state. And people comment that they, too, have noticed changes in the patterns over the last 10 to 20 years. So I want to address some of that going forward. We have a place up on a little cabin built in the 1950s up on Pelican Lake. As somebody who grew up on the East Coast, it took me a while to figure out the whole up north quality of life. I get it now. I've been here for close to 40 years, and it is amazing how Minnesota grows on you. And the things that none of us take for granted, none of us should take for granted, I happen to believe strongly that we have a moral responsibility to care for these things, things that are worthy of our preservation. As an aside, my father grew up in what became East Germany. He told me that he survived Hitler, he survived Stalin, and he drilled this into my brain growing up. He said, actions have consequences. We have rights and we have responsibilities. My father was and is a Reagan Republican who acknowledged that we can have economic prosperity and care for the only planet that God created for us. The two are not mutually exclusive. And so that has resonated with me over the years. As a Christian, I wrote a book with Mitch Hescox, who worked in the coal industry, Now he's in charge of the Evangelical Environmental Network, and we try to come up with ways to frame climate change in a way that might resonate, better resonate, with people of a conservative mindset. And again, it's amazing to me, as a Christian, every major faith group, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, there is a reverence for God's creation, an acknowledgement that we have inherited something special, and we are called to be stewards. One translation of Luke 16:2, man has been appointed as a steward for the management of God's property. Ultimately, he will give account for his stewardship. I don't think it's a controversial thing to say, even if you have no faith, that we are called to be stewards. You mentioned entrepreneur. I've been very blessed to be able to surround myself with people a lot smarter than I am. I'm on my fourth and fifth weather technology company here in Minnesota, and wouldn't think of starting those companies anywhere else. Right now I have two companies that I'm involved with in Eden Prairie, and the reason I mention this is not a cheap plug for my companies. It is, as a founder and as an entrepreneur, if I ignore data that makes me uncomfortable, I will go out of business. I have to keep my eyes wide open to data, to trends, to developments, to new competition, new technology. So that's what I've tried to do. I cannot afford to ignore data that makes me squirm or perhaps does not adhere to my worldview. It's good to be skeptical, especially today, in an era of weaponized news. We should be skeptical about everything. And I think it's worth saying, when it comes to climate change, we all have our own aha moment, right? When there's a critical mass of information and you just shrug your shoulders and say, okay, I've seen enough. I was skeptical when James Hansen testified before Congress in Washington, D.C. back in 1988, and he started using the term global warming. And I, at the time, I didn't see it. And I went through the 80s and 90s trying to keep an open mind, but I wasn't there yet. And then I started noticing changes, perceived changes in the patterns here in Minnesota. When you're a meteorologist, you live the weather. It's not an 8 to 5. You make a forecast, you run to the window, the Amish Doppler, and I started noticing that the weather increasingly was playing out of tune. And that is what pulled me into the peer-reviewed science, and it dawned on me over the span of many years that theory had become reality, that we were actually seeing the symptoms of climate volatility and weather disruption. This wasn't a 30-year down the road thing. It was already showing up in the weather, in the patterns, in the trends. Today we're at 412 parts per million, and it's basic physics. You warm up the atmosphere even slightly by a degree or two or three, and that increases the amount of water in the air. Changes in the Arctic, rapid melting, Arctic amplification, the fact that the Arctic is warming 2 to 3 times faster than Minnesota, may already be showing up in our weather patterns. It's worth reminding everybody that roughly 40% of the additional CO2, their estimates about 38 billion tons of additional CO2 pumped into the atmosphere every single year worldwide. Since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, we've pumped hundreds of billions of additional tons of CO2 and methane into the atmosphere. Energy supply and transportation makes up about 40%, but there are other factors, agriculture, and this is where no crop tilling, no deforestation, the fact that every time you take away a forest, you take away a carbon sink. Industry also provides about 19% of the additional CO2. And we can actually use carbon 14. People point out rightfully that, yes, CO2 is natural, and we need CO2 to survive. The greenhouse effect, if it wasn't in existence, we wouldn't be here. But it's about an optimal level of CO2. And carbon 14, 99% of all the carbon that's floating overhead is carbon 12. But scientists can actually use carbon 14. When you burn fossil fuels, there is no carbon 14. So if you take a volume of gas, you can actually use a lack of carbon 14 to determine the age of the carbon, and therefore how much of that is fossil fuels versus natural sources. So we can detect and measure that human thumbprint. So what we have is an increase from about 280 parts per million to about 412 parts per million since 1880. And again, many times people say parts per million. What's the big deal, Paul? And I gently remind them that arsenic is measured in parts per billion. And doesn't take many parts per billion of arsenic for you to have a bad day. We need oxygen. Yes, we need oxygen to breathe, to survive. Too much oxygen, things begin to spontaneously combust. So there's an optimal range of CO2. And the increase in CO2, which is measured worldwide, corresponds with this warming trend that we're seeing across the planet. We have pretty good instrument records going back to the mid-1800s. Before that, we have proxy data, tree rings, ice core samples, fossil pollen, ocean and lake bottom sediment, coral, and we can go back and get a pretty good trend line showing what temperatures have been doing over time. Geologically, we should be cooling right now when, in fact, temperatures are warming. This graphic is from NASA, and by the way, all of these graphics will be online. So, you know, feel free to go back at your leisure to look up some of these specifics. But according to NASA, this is based on ice core samples. We have good data going back 800,000 years from Antarctica and from Greenland. During that period, 800,000 years, carbon has always been between 180 and 280 parts per million. Now we are at 412. Again, going back 650,000 years or more, atmospheric CO2 has never been above 300 parts per million. We're at 412. The question now, are we going to 500, 600, 800? And scientists tell us it's the rate of CO2 increase that is historically unprecedented. Yes, we've had warmer periods many millions of years ago, but the changes took place over the span of thousands and even tens of thousands of years. It is the rate of increase that has so many scientists so concerned. So, under the heading of let's be skeptical, the first thing that scientists looked at was the sun. Yes, could it be a change in solar radiation, solar irradiance? That is the yellow line. This, again, this is a graphic from NASA, and it shows solar irradiance since 1880. Solar radiation has actually been holding steady, if anything, dropping slightly in recent decades, while global temperature trends have been on the increase. It is not volcanoes. Millions of years ago, when we had planetary volcanoes, hundreds of them going off simultaneously, yes, that produced an immense amount of greenhouse gas, which caused warming. And it has been warmer in the past. Today, the state of Florida releases more CO2 than the world's volcanoes combined. The question that comes up is, how much more warming are we going to have to work through? Is it another 2 or 3 degrees Celsius? The general consensus now is that 2 degrees Celsius of warming is unavoidable. It's in the pipeline. We will adapt. It will be unpleasant at times. There will be disruption. There will be dislocation, especially coastal areas and the southern U.S. 6, 7, 8 degrees Celsius warming, we are living on a different planet. And this is why there is so much concern out there. There's a challenge when it comes to semantics that I've noticed over the years. Global warming, if I'm cold today, Paul, how can the planet be warming? I'm cold. Understandable. Climate change, the climate has always changed. Yes, absolutely. The climate has changed in the past because of forcings, changes in solar radiation, volcanoes, Milankovitch cycles, the wobble of the Earth on its axis. What appears to be happening is that weather that would have happened naturally, floods, droughts, extremes, and we've had extremes since the creation. No argument there. But we seem to be making many of these extremes more extreme. And again, I respond to data and trends, and this was not something that happened overnight. This built up over the course of many, many years, looking at the data. Billion-dollar disasters in the United States have tripled since the 1980s. Now, some of this is demographically driven, more people living in areas they maybe shouldn't be living, next to rivers, along the coastline, but superimposed on that, we are in fact seeing more billion-dollar disasters. This is the actual warming that we have experienced so far in the Twin Cities, about 1.6 Celsius, about 2.9 degrees Fahrenheit since Minnesota became a state. Right now, according to NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the Weather Service folks, we are warming at the rate of about 2 degrees per century. Minnesota statewide has warmed about 3 degrees since the Fort Snelling days, since about 1830. This is a graphic showing the length of the growing season in between the last frost of spring, first frost of winter in Milan, Minnesota, but it's pretty indicative for what we see statewide. Those orange bar graphs are the length of the growing season, and for much of the 20s, 30s, on up to the 70s, and even the 80s in Milan, the average growing season was about 130 days, maybe 135. The most recent decade, since 2010, in Milan, the growing season is now up to about 212 days. And this is a trend that we see not only in Minnesota, but across the upper Midwest. This graphic is from Bob Johnson, the Minnesota Insurance Federation. He shared this with me. A lot of concern, why are insurance premiums going up? And he points out a number of things, including the cost of replacement materials has gone up. But he shared this graphic with me. This is baseball size hail, 2 3/4 inch diameter, the number of days statewide with baseball size hail. I am not yet convinced that this is actually a climate signal. Attribution, confidence levels are high when it comes to flooding, things like tornadoes, hail. We need more studies. We need more research. So I'm not ready to jump on this bandwagon, but he shared this data with me, and I found it interesting. Yes, it gets cold. If it ever gets to the point where we don't see any cold fronts or it doesn't snow in Minnesota, the planet will have much bigger challenges. The winters are warming. Yes, it gets cold. We get polar punches every now and then. We don't see the sustained week after week below zero, or minus 20s and minus 30s, that were fairly common in the Twin Cities as recently as the 70s and early 80s. And again, our winters in the Twin Cities have warmed about 5.7 degrees Fahrenheit since 1970. This is some of the other data that made me do a double take. This is from, again, the National Weather Service, NOAA. And this is the percentage of the United States experiencing extreme flood or extreme drought, what they call the Climate Extreme Index. And for much of the 30s, 40s, on up to about the 80s and even the early 90s, 15 to 20% of the U.S. at any given moment experiencing extreme flood or extreme drought. Recent decades, that number is up closer to 30, 35%. And it should be pointed out that weather nor climate has ever moved in a perfectly straight line. There's a lot of noise. There's a lot of bouncing around. But you step back and you look for the trends. You look for the signal amidst the noise. This is the percentage of the United States experiencing extreme one-day, 24-hour precipitation events. Same thing. Much of the 20s, 30s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, roughly 8 to 10% of the U.S. Recent years, that number is up closer to 15, 17, 18%. The Minnesota DNR defines a mega rain as a multi-county flooding event, 6 inches of rain over an area of at least 1,000 square miles, with a core event over 8 inches. We had two of these mega rainfall events back in 2016 for the first time on record. Now, the Minnesota DNR has gone back looking at newspaper headlines, other forensic evidence. They have pieced this together. They estimate 16 of these mega rainfall events since 1858, since Minnesota became a state. 16. 8 of those have been since 2002. I'm all for coincidence and serendipity, but it certainly appears that we are seeing more frequent flooding events. My dear friend Mark Seely shared this with me. This is not a climate model, a much maligned climate model. This is measuring rainfall in a rain gauge. The average precipitation in the Twin Cities and the changes. It is not a controversial statement to say that Minnesota is getting wetter. We're seeing that in the data. The 30-year average from 41 to 70 was 25.93. The most recent 30-year average since 1981, we're up to 31.16 in the Twin Cities. I go out, I talk to a lot of farmers. I talked to the Farmers Union just last year, and many of these farmers come up to me afterwards and they say, Paul, I don't know if it's climate change, I don't know what to call it, but something has changed. The patterns are different. I see the patterns. This is not what I grew up with. This is not what I remember. Something has changed. And the conversation now is, hey, it's happening. We acknowledge it's happening. What should we be doing? Best practices. What can we do to get those record yields? How do we move forward? This is data from the Minnesota DNR. The information on the left, the number of observations every year of at least 2 inches of rain in one day in Minnesota. And to put this into perspective, back in 1932, it was 12 observations of 2 inches of rain in a day, 12 readings per year. 2002, it was 76 readings of at least 2 inches of rain falling in a day. Same thing when it comes to maximum one-day rainfall recorded every year. Back in 1918, the highest total was just over 3 inches. 1995, close to 10 inches. A warmer atmosphere, even a degree or two or three, can hold more water vapor, and that water is coming down with increasing frequency and ferocity. This is data from the USGS, the U.S. Geological Survey, basically measuring stream flow. Since 1917, the volume of water in our streams and rivers, and all of those blue triangles have seen an increase in stream flow. The bigger the triangle, the bigger the increase. And across most of Minnesota, about a 200 to 300% increase. And we see that same signal showing up all across the Midwest and much of the Northeast as well. So, at the end of the day, the atmosphere does not care what we believe. The atmosphere responds to physics. I'm a capitalist. I believe in market solutions. I believe at the end of the day that this is not going to be solved by a bureaucrat in St. Paul or a bureaucrat in Washington, D.C., but that this will be solved by the markets, creating no carbon, low carbon alternatives so that we can have everything we want, everything we need, and do so with a much lighter touch on the only planet we currently call home. And my take is that nuclear needs to be part of that mix, at least in the short term. My personal opinion as a citizen of this great state is that, and I grew up just downwind of TMI. In fact, we were ready to evacuate. I grew up in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. We had the partial meltdown at TMI in 1979, and my father called me out back, and he said, you know, if this thing blows, I think I can get a job in California. Our bags were packed. The Pennsylvania Turnpike was going to be one way away from Harrisburg, away from TMI, both directions. So we were ready to evacuate. And for the longest time, I was very anti-nuclear. But I've had since a bit of an epiphany. And we're at the point now where I think we need to make some tough choices. And if we can do so responsibly and safely, the ability for nuclear to keep the lights on and not emit any additional CO2 into the atmosphere makes that a fairly attractive alternative. And I think there are new sources of nuclear that are much cheaper, that don't have the issues with plutonium. That's a subject for another day. I drove over here today in an electric vehicle. I've had this thing for 6 years. I've loved each and every one of my fossil fuel vehicles. I've had 38. At one point I was bored and I came up with a spreadsheet. I love those cars. But in 2012 it dawned on me that I'm talking about climate change. What am I driving? And my wife, again, thought I was nuts. I bought a gently used electric vehicle, and I fuel the thing in my garage, and it goes 200 miles. It takes me everywhere I need to go. My insurance rates have gone down. There really is no maintenance. There's 150 moving parts on this vehicle. Typical gas-powered vehicle, 10,000. Moving parts. There's just less that can go wrong. Every spring, I call Tesla and I say, should I bring it in for a checkup? And they go, well, Paul, if you're feeling insecure, you can bring it in. You don't have to. It feels like I'm driving for free. The prices have come down. And now you can get into an electric vehicle in the 30s. They are cheaper to produce, they are cheaper to maintain and operate. Within 3 to 5 years, batteries will go 500 miles and they will be priced in the 20s. I don't think our grandkids or great-grandkids will care one iota that they're getting around town in an electric vehicle versus a fossil fuel vehicle. This is part of the solution. I am not a paragon of green virtue. I'm trying to take steps in my own life to reduce my carbon footprint. I think there are things we can do to lower risk. And again, something my father drilled into me as a conservative, why wouldn't you do everything in your power to lower risk? I would argue that there's already a signal in the market. Is a tax politically possible or palatable? Probably not. Citizens Climate Lobby talks about fee and dividend. Put a fee on carbon when it's emitted. Everybody gets a dividend check. That may be more palatable. But I would argue that Xcel Energy going carbon neutral by 2050 puts a signal in the market. I would argue that 3M committing to run all of their plants, all of their facilities worldwide with only renewable energy, clean renewable energy by 2050 puts a signal in the market. My question, and I don't pretend to have the answer key, is how do we turn up the volume and move faster? How do we amplify that signal so that the markets can respond with the services and the products we need? Because I could make an argument, and I think many have made this argument, that we're going to need to adapt. Everything we do will have to be more storm-proof, flood-resistant, drought-tolerant. We need new methods, new materials. What worked in the 1980s is not going to work in the 2020s or the 2030s. And specifically for Minnesota, all the climate models show us continuing to get wetter. We have been blessed with water, which is something that the West is going to be coveting at some point. We have water, and frequently we have too much water. So dealing with these extremes in weather whiplash, going from flood to drought. The trends are encouraging, at least I find them encouraging. The most recent year there's data, and forgive me if you know this already, but 25% of Minnesota's energy diet coming from renewable sources, a 300% increase statewide since 2007. And wind power capacity, roughly 18.1%. of our electrical power in 2017 was fueled by wind. A statistic that never ceases to amaze me, enough sunlight strikes the earth every hour to power the entire world's economy for 1 year. So we have a challenge. How do we harvest the free, clean, renewable energy that is already out there, that is already creating jobs in the United States 12 times faster than the rest of the economy? Number one job, wind turbine technician. Six-figure salary, must not be afraid of heights. At the end of the day, and again, a lot of people lead with the gloom and the doom, and I think when you lead with gloom and doom, and not to say there won't be disruption, there will be, but when you lead with gloom and doom, people shut down. If you lead with solutions and hope, I think you've got a chance of getting people to listen. I'm optimistic for two reasons. One is the arc of technology and the fact that prices are falling across the board for renewables. The same breakthroughs we saw in cell phone technology, semiconductors, prices falling. That's happening. At some point, even if you think climate change is a hoax, it's a scandal, it's a political agenda, at some point you will think about signing up for wind or solar because going green will put more green back in your pocket. I'm also optimistic because younger people are, as a rule, less cynical and less skeptical. So at the end of the day, this is not about polar bears. This is about our kids. What responsibility do we have for those who come next, for our kids and their kids? And again, and I tell skeptics, and it's good to be skeptical. You don't believe the meteorologist. You don't believe the climate scientist. You don't believe your minister or your rabbi or your imam. Do yourself a favor. Believe your own eyes, because the symptoms are going to be harder to dismiss and deny over time. And again, I am buoyed by the fact that every threat is an opportunity for renewal, resilience, and ultimately reinvention. Thank you.
And thank you so much for coming. We really appreciate it. We know you have to get back because you have a show this afternoon.
So. Yes.
And we will make sure that if there are questions, we will gather those up, and Mike Molzan will share them with you.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Appreciate
so much. Next on our agenda is Rusty Collier from Unipor. And I thank you, staff, for handing this out. This is from some of our business folks in Unipor. You are on here, too. So thank you.
Thank you, everyone. I'm going to be brief. I have to be in Apple Valley in about 35, 40 minutes. So
we have just a little bit of time, too, so that works perfectly.
All right. Well, again, thank you. And I just want to say on behalf of the nine businesses I'll be sharing a letter with everyone here, thank you for having us. As major business and employer in Minnesota, we are here representing, and Upanor is here representing, the transition to the low-carbon economy. We're supporting decarbonization. We believe in the science of global climate change, and we are, as a business, recognizing that we have a part to play, not just because of what we do, but because of who we employ and where they come from, and the fact that everyone deserves something better than what they may get without having climate change taken into check. So my name is Rusty Collier. I represent Upanor. I'm the Director of Corporate Responsibility and Sustainability. I work out of our Apple Valley headquarters, which is our North American headquarters, but I actually work directly for our Upanor group out of Helsinki, Finland. When we talk about global climate change and we talk about decarbonization, it's a very easy conversation to have at our headquarters in Helsinki. It's basically, let's go find what the best price is on renewable power, renewable generation technologies, and let's look to what those can bring into the business. We're finding that that's not difficult to do in Minnesota, but it is more challenging because there's more dialogue yet on whether or not it's the right thing to do. So from the standpoint of Upanor, is we believe the science, we believe that action is needed, and we're here to support. And in fact, we're supporting it through taking on initiatives around sustainable development goals. We have identified four critical and urgent, climate change being one of them. We have plans out to 2025 to bring on tactics that will do our part to lessen our carbon footprint, one thing being movement to 100% renewable by 2025, and that's very important to us. We're also looking at ways to improve the technologies of our production, and over the last years we've made significant improvements in energy reduction activities. We found a lot of support in the state through the Environmental Initiative and through SERES, as well as other entities that are represented throughout the state. And the good thing about all that is that it's the evidence of what it can do for businesses in terms of looking at your overhead and using renewables to actually be a leverage to secure more of a fixed cost over a longer term, being able to talk to your investors and employees about what you're doing so that as they come to wonder, well, what is my company doing in terms of battling the climate change problems, we can give them a clear answer. And it's a proof answer. It's not speculation. So with that, I have the letter that I mentioned, and I don't know who I leave that with, but I'm going to leave it. Okay. And I'd also like to point out that the other companies that are involved in this, we all feel the same. Some of them will be able to speak for themselves. Others will be represented in what you read. So with that, I'm going to wrap up and just say thank you again for taking the time to listen, and I'm more than happy to answer any questions.
I don't see any questions right now. Appreciate your being with us. I appreciate it. And you are next to you?
I'm Dan Scheibel.
Thank you so much. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. Esteemed members of the conference committee,
As I said, my name is Dan Scheibel. I'm the Global Sustainability Manager at Aveda. Aveda is a hair care and skin care company that was started here in Minneapolis about 40 years ago. We're currently officed up in Blaine, Minnesota. We're part of the Estee Lauder family of companies. As you examine the importance of clean energy on the state of Minnesota, the residents, and the companies based here, I want to provide you a little bit of information about Aveda's environmental mission. Since our inception, Aveda has tried to focus on limiting its impact on the environment. From never testing on animals to being leaders in using post-consumer recycled material in our packaging, Aveda was the very first beauty company to use 100% wind power. Starting in 2005, we worked with Xcel Energy to develop a program on clean electricity. We wanted a source of clean electricity to run our operations in Blaine. To that end, it was determined we'd pay a green tariff, an additional charge for our electricity. From the wind farms developed by Xcel, Aveda will pay this additional cost for wind power to have renewable energy credits. We don't have wind turbines on site in Blaine, mainly because the airport would really not like that in Anoka County. But we still use this wind power claim on our packaging material. So if you're actually to look at our bottle, we actually print it on our bottles. But you'll actually see it if you go into an Aveda salon or into an Aveda store. Now, not all the energy it takes to run our manufacturing facility is electric. So we needed to ensure that the natural gas that we actually burn for either heating the building or manufacturing our product was also additionally offset due to the carbon dioxide that's emitted when you burn natural gas. This resulted in us purchasing additional carbon offsets to cover our natural gas consumption. So when you talk about climate change, you talk about Scope 1 and Scope 2, we're covering off on both our Scope 1 and our Scope 2 emissions. As I mentioned earlier, Aveda is part of the Estee Lauder brand of companies. In 2017, Estee Lauder joined the Renewable Energy 100, also known as the RE100, which is a group of companies committed to source 100% of their global electricity from renewable energy. Our goal for the Estee Lauder companies is to be 100% renewable by 2020, and we're well on the way. In addition to the energy that we offset, Aveda believes that it's our responsibility to reduce our impact on the products that we create. That's why we also actually offset our carbon emissions from the manufacture and use of our aerosol hairsprays. For a bit of broader context related to energy and clean energy, states of Washington and New Mexico recently passed clean energy bills. Google, which I think everybody has probably heard of, is requesting clean energy for the data center that they're proposing to build near Becker. It's a $600 million project. Uponor has their own goals. Businesses around the world and in Minnesota are requesting clean energy, and we as a state are very well positioned to be a leader in this space. Aveda, along with Uponor and other companies, are part of the Minnesota Sustainable Growth Coalition, a group of over 25 companies whom you will probably recognize a lot of them, and also nonprofit entities and the state, look at advancing a circular economy within the state and in those areas where we operate. Additionally, the issue of clean energy and climate change is becoming more important to young people and the impacts it has on them. Last week on the steps of the Capitol, there were students that walked out of school to protest the fact that there's not been enough done on climate change. In London, there have been protests shutting down different parts of the city protesting climate change. Our guests and our customers will start voting with their wallet if they don't believe that we are actually doing the right thing on climate change and for the environment. The use of clean energy provides real benefits to communities throughout the state. Jobs are created both rurally and urban from the gigantic wind turbines that I can see from my cabin at MinTac to people installing solar panels on houses in and around the, you know, Twin Cities. An example of this is the fact that in the facility where Blaine is and where I work, we're working on about a 860 kilowatt solar array, which is going to be installed by a Minnesota-based company. Solar and wind don't produce carbon emissions or particulates that go into the air. The particulates that come from, as Paul Douglas mentioned, fossil fuel vehicles or fossil fuel power plants cause health impacts to people within the state, causing increased illnesses and higher medical costs. We as a state have the opportunity not only for power generation, but also the conversion to electric vehicles. As none of this is going to be able to change overnight, we have the responsibility to start converting Minnesota to a clean energy economy. There's one quick story that I wanted to share with you. In 2015, the former governor of the state of California, Arnold Schwarzenegger, asked a question of climate deniers. He gave them this proposal. There's two doors. Behind door number one is a completely sealed room with a regular gasoline car running. Behind door number two is an identical completely sealed room with an electric car with its engine running. You get to choose one of the two doors. You go into the room, you don't get to leave, you don't get to shut off the engine, and you don't get a mask. Which one do you choose? I think the choice is sort of obvious. In closing, I don't want to be the person to try to explain to my grandchildren or my children that I didn't do anything to stop climate change. I hope you understand the importance on this topic for generations to come. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your coming. I don't see questions, but if there are questions, we will get them to you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Greg Mast, Clean Energy Economy of Minnesota. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Greg Mast, and I am the Executive Director of Clean Energy Economy Minnesota. We are an industry-led, nonpartisan, not-for-profit organization dedicated to growing and strengthening Minnesota's clean energy business ecosystem. Our membership is comprised of clean energy companies ranging from startups and small businesses to Fortune 100 and 500 corporations who employ thousands of Minnesotans across the state. Simply put, we are the business voice for the clean energy industry. I appreciate the opportunity to testify before you today because policy leadership provides a crucial level of certainty required to open the marketplace for clean energy solutions. With strong, stable clean energy policies, Minnesota will continue to attract jobs and investments that will enable our state to thrive and to prosper. Without them, we will be at a competitive disadvantage. More plainly, accelerating our transition to a clean, affordable, and secure energy system will increase Minnesota's competitive position, deliver jobs, and spur additional economic opportunities and benefits for all Minnesotans. I'd like to thank both the House and Senate committees for your leadership and work this session, and for your willingness to discuss bold clean energy ideas and proposals. Our organization believes that clean energy works for everyone, and we like to say that we work between the aisle, not across it. It's important to note that clean energy has strong bipartisan support from bill authors and in the House and Senate. I'd like to thank Senator Pratt and Representative Long for their work on expanding financing options for energy efficiency and clean energy. I'd like to extend our thanks to Senator Osmick and Representative Claflin for their leadership on energy storage. And I'd also like to thank Senator Simonson and Representative Wagenius for sitting down with us to discuss the state energy fact sheet, which shows how costs for clean energy continue to compete and win in markets, as well as for their desire to have a two-way dialogue with clean energy businesses on how state energy policies are making a positive difference in our company's day-to-day operations and also for their customers. The House package supports the transition to a clean, affordable, and reliable energy system while it unleashes economic opportunities across our state. And Minnesota is not alone in this undertaking. There are currently 18 states that have passed, are considering, or are introducing 100% clean energy legislation. This dramatic shift in our energy system is being driven in part by demand from big employers, like what you've heard already this afternoon. And in fact, three-quarters of Fortune 100 companies have some form of clean energy goal or target, including some of Minnesota's largest corporations, including 3M, Target, General Mills, Ecolab, Cargo, and many more. Both the Senate and House bills are also support technologies like electric vehicles, which are increasingly becoming integrated into our energy system. They also both support the study of energy storage, a critical tool in the energy toolbox that experts believe is a key part of any transition to 100% clean energy. These components of the bill complement the trends that we're seeing in other forward-looking states who are competing with us for clean energy business, and you have the opportunity to set a positive direction for Minnesota's clean energy future. In terms of economic impacts, Minnesota is now home to over 61,000 clean energy jobs, and these jobs are growing at a rate 2.5 times faster than all other sectors of our state's economy, according to the 2019 Clean Jobs Midwest report. And I think each of you should have received a letter and an infographic that has some additional details on clean energy jobs throughout the state. The Senate conferees represent districts that are home to one out of every 12 clean energy jobs in Minnesota. As we often note, nearly 40% of clean energy jobs reside throughout greater Minnesota. So costs of wind and solar have dropped 16 and 23% respectively in the last year alone, according to a recent analysis by Bloomberg New Energy Finance that we released this spring. Minnesota is also consistently recognized as one of the top states for energy efficiency. Expanding Minnesota's demand-side management goals and investments is key to creating additional savings and economic growth. The growth in jobs and downward trends in technology costs are bringing benefits to all corners of our state. All of this as Minnesota households enjoy retail electricity bills that are 13% below the national average. It should also be noted that this package also envisions thoughtful transitions for communities that are linked to legacy energy assets. And so from Pipestone to Pelican Rapids, from Rochester to Duluth, from Uptown to Mountain Iron, our state's economy is benefiting from strong clean energy policies. In closing, Minnesota businesses are leading the way. They know that clean tech is now main tech, and they're planning accordingly. We also know that along the way, transitioning to a clean grid will triple our clean energy workforce by providing policy certainty and market-enabling opportunities for businesses. You'll be doing the right thing for economic growth and for all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And next, if you want to introduce yourself for the record.
Yeah, my name is Brendan Slaughterback. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am a program officer with the Midwest Climate and Energy Team with the McKnight Foundation. I'm honored to be here today to talk to you about the Minnesota Smarter Grid report that McKnight supported. Thank you for this opportunity. I'm going to provide just a brief background on McKnight, why we supported this study, and then a few of the key findings from the report. I believe you should be seeing two handouts that summarize some of the results from that report. McKnight is a family foundation based in Minneapolis. Our mission is to advance a more just, creative, and abundant future where people and planet thrive. Over the last 10 years, McKnight has invested over $900 million in Minnesota across a number of issues, including education, rural and regional economic development, affordable housing, the arts, Mississippi River water quality, and transportation. Among our grant-making programs, we support Midwestern leadership in advancing clean energy and making the region a model for the country and the world. As part of our approach, the Foundation regularly commissions independent third-party research to help us and the public better understand the context in the areas where we work. As this committee knows well, we are in the midst of a rapid technological and economic change in the energy sector. Clean energy technologies like wind are now our cheapest new resources. As we've heard, new consumer choices like electric vehicles, battery storage, are growing quickly, and our state's energy utilities are making extremely bold pledges to deploy clean options, not just to improve environmental outcomes, but to support their financial bottom line. Given these rapid changes, and based on what we have been hearing from our partners in industry, nonprofit sector, and utilities, the Foundation's leadership felt it was important to provide an analytical underpinning to the discussions around the energy transition occurring in our state and region. To do this, in late 2017, we engaged Vibrant Clean Energy and Dr. Chris Clack, who has some of the most comprehensive tools in the industry, to understand the impacts to reliability and affordability as Minnesota's electricity, transportation, and building sectors continue the transition to clean energy. In other words, as we make this transition, will we be able to keep the lights on and keep energy affordable? Dr. Clack and his team analyzed 13 scenarios, which I will not go into all 13, but they are designed to show different pathways to Minnesota's statutory pollution reduction and clean energy goals. Most of these scenarios assume significant electrification of the transportation and building sector, which is likely necessary to meet our goals. Generation and load were balanced across the entire Eastern Interconnect, which is another way of saying that this model is able to portray how Minnesota's grid interacts with the regional system. Within each scenario, the model sought to identify the least cost portfolio of generation and demand-side flexibility out to the year 2050. There are three main conclusions from the report that I'd like to share today. First of all, Minnesota's electrical grid was reliable in all the scenarios that Dr. Clack modeled, including with very high levels of renewables. The model looked at load and generation every 5 minutes, and even up to 100% clean electricity, the system can be reliable at all times of the year. Diverse resources such as wind, solar, storage, nuclear, natural gas, and the flexibility of electrical loads like EV charging all play a role in the model in meeting our energy needs, as does our interconnection with the larger MISO and regional grid. The second conclusion, in all of the scenarios that were modeled, electricity prices go down. Under a 100% clean electricity scenario, rates would fall by 26% by 2050 under a least cost planning scenario. This is driven in large part by the replacement of fossil fuel generating units with less expensive clean energy technology that has no fuel costs. Third and finally, a continued energy transition will be good for Minnesota's health and supercharge our clean energy industries, as Greg has just discussed. In addition to reducing greenhouse gases, clean energy scenarios all show a significant reduction in pollutants harmful to human health. We would triple the number of jobs in the energy sector, including 14,000 wind and 36,000 solar jobs by 2050. In summary, the analysis shows us that we can meet our state's clean energy and climate goals while we grow jobs, save money on energy bills, and reduce pollution dramatically while maintaining a reliable energy system. Thank you for the opportunity and your time and attention. I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee might have.
I don't see any questions. Thank you both for being here. We have one last testifier, Kevin Pranis. Welcome. We have about 3 minutes left.
I'll keep it short. Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Kevin Pranis, and I'm here today on behalf of LIUNA, Minnesota, North Dakota, a union of more than 12,000 proud men and women who build and maintain our state's transportation, water, energy, and building infrastructure. I want to thank the chair and the representatives and senators who have been working very hard to figure out energy policy for the state in a bipartisan fashion. Our members know a little bit about energy. For decades, we've worked alongside building trades brothers and sisters to build and safely maintain Minnesota's fleet of conventional and nuclear power plants, and a growing number of members are employed in the solar and wind industries. We build and maintain gas and oil pipelines and distribution lines and work at refineries in Minnesota and in Superior, Wisconsin. Our state is a national leader when it comes to electric power. Our rates are below the national average, and we're way ahead when it comes to efficiency and reliability. Our success is founded on a strong utility regulation and partnerships with responsible investor-owned utilities, municipal utilities, and cooperatives. And it depends on the work of a skilled union workforce that's kept the system reliable and affordable while providing middle-class paychecks, comprehensive health coverage, and retirement security to thousands of families across Minnesota. Our international union believes in an all-of-the-above energy policy. So our test, when we look at clean energy policy, is whether it's achievable based on what we know about demand, resources, and technology. Does it provide flexibility to utilities and other stakeholders to pursue strategies that work? Does it include safeguards to protect residential and business ratepayers and ensure reliability? And does it expand opportunity for Minnesota workers, businesses, and communities? We believe the policy proposals put forward by Governor Walz, adopted by the House, and adopted or under discussion in the Senate, including the core Clean Energy First proposal as well as the work on efficiency, meet these tests. We think it's a huge opportunity for Minnesotans to move forward, especially for our members and communities in greater Minnesota that have substantial opportunities to benefit from ample wind and solar resources and the opportunity for distributed generation. At the same time, these bills have been crafted in a way that we believe protects the industries we work in, whether it's building, highway-heavy industries, whether it's refineries or electric utilities, or the mining industry, that we believe is effectively protected by these bills. And we think there's an opportunity, because of the work that's been put into these bills, to recognize the importance of industry, to actually make gains, to see not only Minnesota construction workers go to work building this economy, but ideally to see Minnesota metals, Minnesota steel and Minnesota iron and copper go into rebuilding this economy. We think this is an important transition to make, and it's important to begin planning now. We appreciate all the work that's happened, and we really hope for a bipartisan solution to investment in our energy infrastructure that helps move Minnesota's workers and communities forward.
Thank you so much for coming. Thank you. Committee, we're now going to shift, and we're on schedule. And we're going to ask staff to walk through the side-by-sides and the spreadsheet. And Mr. Eloff? I think let's do the side-by-sides first.
Madam Chair and members, there's a lot of material here. There's a lot of material that is either House only or Senate only language, and I'll talk about the House only language. Ms. Doyle will talk about the Senate only language. There is, happily, language that is in both bills. We'll talk about that as well. And we also have a lot of material related to the Conservation Improvement Program, which is in both bills, but very different. And I'll try to highlight the differences in House and Senate language, and also the differences between the House and Senate language and current statute. So I think we'll begin on page R5, skipping the appropriations, which I think will be looked at more closely in the spreadsheets. Looking at the House language on the bottom of page 5, that's the initial section of...
excuse me, Madam Chair.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could I ask which article we're starting on? Because when I start to R5, I'm seeing Senate-only language in the energy article, which is where I thought we were starting.
I'm starting on Article 29.
Okay, I'm on 28. Sorry.
I'm sorry. Madam Chair and members, I think Bob has a probably an earlier version. It would be on the bottom of R1. I don't think you have appropriations. It was probably an earlier draft. I have a document dated May 6th, 8:15 a.m. But he will be starting with Article 20. Is it 29? 29 on the House side. So I'll try to reference the are the numbers if he gets off on a different number.
Yeah,
if he's probably got this marked up. So
if all we look at the lines, I think we'll be fine rather than the pages.
Ms. Doyle is correct. I'll try to mentally subtract 4 pages from my references. I can only do it this way. It's okay. Nice. So we are on page R1 at the bottom. At section 1 in the House language is some language that's attached to later language on page R10 regarding the ability of customers and third parties to obtain energy usage data from municipal utilities. In this section, just says that that data is private data on individuals or non-public data, and includes that the that data may be released to people authorized to receive the data under that later language. And I'll get to that when we get to that page.
The next section is on the Senate side. And this section one makes several changes to the renewable development account statute. One of the major things that it does on page R2 is in beginning in 2020, it will fix Xcel's annual contribution to the renewable development account. And so you'll see that on starting on line 99.16, it sets a number for 2020, and then it sets it at $20 million to the for the RDA in 2022 and thereafter. And then after both of the Prairie Island and Monticello plants are closed, then there are some also some numbers there that are referenced, whether or not one or the other is open. Let's see, then another thing change I want to point out in the statute is on page R3. This would allow Xcel on line 100.34, it would allow them, Xcel, to recover funds that are withheld for the CASP payments, and that has to be done through a rate rider. And then on page R4, line 102.3, this section or this paragraph is regarding the advisory group that is established to do the RFP for the renewable development account for the projects that the advisory group would do. And it clarifies that Xcel would choose the members of the advisory group other than the member appointed by the tribal council. On page R5, it on line 102.20, in that paragraph, it would allow Xcel to withhold money for the third-party evaluator and caps that at $125,000 a year. On the bottom of page R5, this language allows for a mechanism for determining when there's enough money in the RDA, if there would ever be enough money in the account to have a grant cycle. And on page R6 at the top, it states that if there's more than $15 million in the renewable available as of January 31st of the year, that would trigger the advisory group to issue an RFP. And I think those are most of the changes that are in that paragraph. I believe all of this language, I don't think we changed it on the Senate side. This was in the vetoed supplemental budget bill last year, just to let the committee or to let the conference committee know that as well. On the bottom of page R6, this is the same statutory reference. The Senate only makes one change to this is the solar rewards program for Xcel. It makes a change on lines 249.11 and 64.20 from direct to alternating current when determining the aggregate nameplate capacity per premise. And then there are some changes that the House makes.
Yes, at the bottom of that page, the House adds money to the latter years of the project and also extends the solar rewards project by an additional year and allocates $5 million in that additional year.
On page R7, there is a section that is Senate only. This would establish a community energy transition grant program, and this would be for grants for communities that are hosting electric generating power plants that are set to be decommissioned or retired, and it would allow these communities that apply for the grants to conduct some economic development types of activities, and there would be an advisory council that would be established to look at the proposals that are submitted, and then it would be run by the Department of Employment and Economic Development. And that section goes all the way over to R10.
And on R10, on the House side, is a continuation of that language dealing with access to customer energy data. This language allows sets up a procedure by which customers can obtain from their utility access to their own data. It also allows a customer to designate a third party that can obtain access to the customer's own data. and also allows any member of the public to access the aggregated data of at least 15 customers, and also allows the utilities to impose a fee for providing this information, except with respect to the customer accessing their own data in a standard format. It also requires at the bottom of page R12 that the utility establish appropriate industry standard safeguards to protect the security of the energy data.
On page R13, there's a Senate-only provision. This provision was added on the floor of the Senate, and it would address costs related to any new nuclear plant that is constructed after June 1st of 2019. It would not allow costs to be recovered until the plant is operational and used for service. And this relates to addresses an issue that might be brought up by getting rid of the prohibition on construction of new nuclear plants that I'll discuss later on in the bill.
On page R14 is language that is almost identical. It allows public utilities to petition the commission to recover costs of an energy storage system pilot project that the utility wishes to do. And on page R15, section 5 in the House language, allows public utility to recover expenses incurred to employ local workers to construct and maintain generation facilities. Both the House and the Senate made significant changes in the community solar garden statute. Why don't I discuss the House, and then we can go to the Senate. So we're still on page R15. And I'll move to the top of actually of page R16, which is the first major change in the House language. It increases the nameplate capacity, the maximum nameplate capacity of community solar gardens from 1 to 3 megawatts. Further down on the page is language that allows for an exemption from the current requirement that subscribers to a community solar garden be customers or be located in the same or a contiguous county as the solar garden itself. This language will allow an exemption from that if two conditions are met. One, the solar garden has a minimum setback of 100 feet from the nearest residence, and two, the owner or operator of the garden certifies that at least 10% of the garden's generating capacity will be reserved for residential subscribers. Also at the top of page R17 is language in the House requiring that beginning in January 1st, 2020, solar garden applications filed with the utility must certify that workers constructing the solar garden will be paid at the prevailing wage. The next language regarding solar gardens that I'd like to point out is on page R20, subdivision 4. This would require the Department of Commerce to begin administering the Community Solar Garden Program in 2020. The House language also creates two new kinds of community solar gardens. One is on page R21 at the top. It's called a community access project. And what that means is at least 50% of the solar garden's generating capacity is subscribed by residential customers. And as a result, towards the bottom of that page, lines 258.20 and 21, the public utility purchases all energy from these kinds of gardens at the retail rate. On page R23, there's a new Section 7 in the House, which creates another new type of solar garden. It's called for low-income households. This would be made up entirely of households that met the income eligibility requirement, meaning 50% less of the state median household income or 200% or less of the federal poverty level. These gardens would also have to be managed by either a community action agency or a tribal or county governmental agency or any nonprofit that currently administers low-income energy programs for the Department of Commerce. These gardens also, at the bottom of the page, can have a maximum capacity of 500 kilowatts. Grants awarded under this project, I'm now in the middle of page R24, can provide for up to 60% of the total cost to develop these kinds of gardens.
So the Senate's plan is quite a bit different for the community solar gardens, but that it begins back on page R15. Under the Senate language, the utility subject to this section, which is Excel, would submit a new plan for community solar gardens to the Public Utilities Commission by September 30th of 2019. And under the new scheme, the Excel would select qualified proposals from those that are submitted, and then those would be submitted to the Public Utilities Commission for final approval, but they're not changed by the Public Utilities Commission. And then the total nameplate capacity of the qualified proposals selected by the commission will not exceed 25 megawatts per year. That's on line 66.25. The also on page R16, under this language, the value of solar calculation is eliminated, and instead that is submitted with along with the qualified proposal, or the with Excel's plan would include the rates for purchase of the energy. On page R17, this is this section is a combination of a couple of Senate proposals. One, it changes the community solar garden program, but then also there are a number of consumer protection measures that were added. On page R17, starting on line 68.3, these are the disclosures and other information that needs to be provided to subscribers. And that is down to the bottom of page R17. Then also on page R18, that continues on what type of information needs to be provided and also submitted to the Public Utilities Commission. On the bottom of page R18, this requires the community solar garden developers on line 69.18 to submit a registration form to the Public Utilities Commission, and then it discusses the information that needs to be included on that registration with the Public Utilities Commission. On page R19, on line 70.17, it talks about what is a qualified proposal under the Community Solar Garden Program, and specifically it says that a qualified proposal on line 70.21 must deliver at least 60% of the energy generated by the community solar garden to residential customers. And then it also specifies other qualifications for a proposal to be a qualified proposal. Over onto page R20. On line 70.29 to 71.2, it talks about it requires the commission to develop some formulas to be used by solar garden owners to estimate the annual amount of electricity generated by a solar garden, and also a formula for solar garden owners to estimate the length of time required to fully recover subscribers' lump sum payments. And that ends the changes to the community solar garden for the Senate. What page is that?
On page R21 near the top is subdivision 2, or, no, excuse me.
R22.
On page R24, at the bottom, section 8 of the House language specifies that the commission's approval of power purchase agreements to satisfy the wind and energy or the wind or biomass mandates must be must approve expenditures net of revenues.
I'm sorry, I'm going to go back to page R22. We missed one Senate-only provision. This was added on the floor by Senator Housley, and this is regarding the recognition of beneficial habitat at solar solar sites, and this would require any owner of a solar site to report on its site management practices to the Board of Water and Soil Resources on the a standard form that they have created on its solar site management practices. And if they have to do this if they're making a beneficial habitat claim under the statute.
On page R25 near the top is section 9 of the House language, which specifies that employment of local workers to construct and maintain generation facilities, that cost recovery can be had for those types of expenditures. Both the House and the Senate make changes in the definition portion of the renewable energy standard on page R25. Well, the Senate's on page R25.
On the Senate side, the reason that this statute or this section is in for on the Senate side is because it would, on line 71.26, it would remove the capacity cap for hydroelectric power. And currently, you can only include small hydro that's less than 100 megawatts to be treated as renewable power, but this would remove that cap to allow it to be used as renewable power.
And the House amends these definitions at the top of page R26 by adding a definition of carbon-free, meaning a technology that generates electricity without emitting carbon dioxide. Also on that page, section 11 in the House language amends the subdivision of the renewable energy standard that allows for allows the utility to request a modification or delay of the standard from the Public Utilities Commission. And the language added at lines 263.13 and 14 require the commission to take into account the environmental costs that might result from such a modification or delay. And at the very bottom of that page, when a modification or delay is requested on the basis of transmission capacity constraints, at the top of page R27, there's additional language saying what needs to be taken into consideration under that. Again, on page R27, in the middle of the page, there's a definition of carbon-free standard added to the definition section, which requires utilities that are subject to the renewable energy standard to have 100% of their total retail electric sales to retail consumers in Minnesota generated from carbon-free technologies by the end of 2050. At the bottom of R27, section 13, requires the commission to take all reasonable actions within its authority to ensure that the implementation of the RES is done in a manner that maximizes benefits to all Minnesotans, especially to workers, local workers in the state. In the middle of page R28 is additional House language in section 14, which requires public utilities to file with the commission by January 1st, 2021, an application to install one or more energy storage systems on their grid. And at the bottom of page R29 is language that indicates the utility can recover the costs from their ratepayers of that pilot program. There's also House-only language on page R30, section 15, allows public utilities to petition the commission to invest up to $5 million a year on innovative clean technologies. And section 16 at the bottom of the page, actually the change I want to talk to is at the top of page R31. This section would increase the state's annual energy savings goal from 1.5 to 2.5%. And the additional language at in paragraph B, starting at 269.1, encourages the utilities to design and offer load management programs that will assist in reaching that goal. Members, the next 26 pages from are concerning the Conservation Improvement Program, which is Minnesota's main conservation program. It's been operating since the mid-1980s. This is a major overhaul to that program, and one of the things it does is reorganize that statute. Currently, the statute is organized according to issues. Energy savings goals are described for all three types of utilities: investor-owned utilities, municipal utilities, and cooperative electric associations. One of the things this new language does is separate the issues according to the type of utility. Municipals and cooperatives are deemed consumer-owned utilities, COUs, in contrast to the investor-owned utilities and IOUs. So what this does is repeat a lot of existing language, but it looks like new language because it's written specifically to apply to consumer-owned utilities. What I'll try to do is highlight the differences between the House and the Senate language and also the differences in both of these languages from current statute. The first few pages are definitions, which I'll skip over. Let me turn to page R34, which begins the language that refers to consumer-owned utilities, both rural electrical co-ops and municipal utilities. And the first change I want to discuss is actually on page R35 at the top. Both the House and Senate retain the current statutory 1.5% energy savings goal each year, which utilities are required to meet. The House also retains the current statute language that at least 1% of that 1.5 come from energy conservation investments, or energy conservation improvements, which I guess I was defined as traditional energy conservation. If you have an audit done of your house, you're going to get recommendations coming back with doing things like insulation, increasing the efficiency of lighting and various things like that. That's what we refer to as energy conservation improvements. The Senate reduces the current 1% requirement for COUs to 0.75% to come from energy conservation improvements. But both bills allow for additional types of energy savings to count towards the 1.5% energy goals. One of these is called electric utility infrastructure projects, which are defined as projects that replace or modify infrastructure that's owned by utilities, including their buildings, to use either less energy or use energy more efficiently. It also includes new savings that are derived from what's called efficient fuel switching improvements on line 272.25 in the House, and these are called efficient electrification and conversion improvements in the Senate language on line 83.28. So that's a new category of savings that can be applied to that 1.5% energy goal, and I'll be discussing that a little bit more when the language defining that is reached a little bit later today. The Senate also has, at line 83.30, another category of savings that can be applied to the 1.5% SIP solar rebates that meet criteria, which will be discussed later. There's also a difference in that energy savings that are above the 1.5% can be carried forward for 3 years under the House language and up to 5 years under the Senate language. Turning to page R36, in the middle of the page in the House language allows the commissioner to adjust the savings goal for a utility that requests it to a level the commissioner determines is supported by the record. The House language says that this cannot be less than 1% of that 1.5%. The adjustment language at the top of page R36 from the Senate also has that adjustment language. There is no minimum, but I'd point out there is no minimum in the current law either for municipals and co-ops. Subdivision 3 on page R36 is existing language that has spending goals for utilities. Although the current law also says that a utility can't meet its energy savings goal by meeting the spending goals. But that language has been retained in current law, and it's retained in this version in the House language but not in the Senate language. Turning to page R37, at the top, the Senate language doesn't require that the annual energy savings goal be met every year. It allows for a multi-year conservation improvement plan that an average of 1.5% be met over the term of that plan. That's flexibility that's not in the House language. The other language on this page concerns annual updates that utilities must make regarding the conservation improvement plan. And the requirement for the Senate is, I'd say, less than the House. The Senate is required only to talk about the amount of money that's being spent and the expenditures and investments. The language on page R37 at the bottom of the page goes into greater detail as to what is expected to be reported in those annual updates from, consumer-owned utilities. And specifically at the top of page R38, paragraph C talks about how cost-effectiveness of utility programs must be evaluated. Lines 275.20, the utilities in evaluating the cost-effectiveness must consider the costs and benefits to ratepayers, the utilities, participants, and society. These are typical tests that are done for energy efficiency programs across the country, and it's the way that it's done under department rules here in Minnesota. That language is not in the Senate language. Another new language in the House bill is at the bottom of page R38, paragraph G, which requires the Energy Conservation and Optimization Plan to include activities to improve energy efficiencies in the public schools that the utility serves. That language is also not in a Senate language. Page R39 discusses low-income programs that utilities are required to offer. Currently, under current statute, municipal utilities that furnish gas service must spend at least 0.2% of their average gross operating revenue on such programs. In the House, this is increased to 0.4%. It remains at 0.2% in the Senate language. And currently, consumer-owned utilities that furnish electric service must spend 0.2%. That again, I'm sorry, 0.1%. That is bumped up to 0.4% in the Senate language, and on line 85.34, 0.2% in the Senate language. Otherwise, the rest of this subdivision is identical language for both the House and the Senate. On page R40, looking at subdivision 6, recovery of expenses, that is identical language in both the House and Senate. The next subdivision, ownership of energy conservation improvement, is similar. You'll notice on page 87, line 21 to 23, there's language talking about the utility having no liability for loss, damage, or injury caused by energy conservation improvements. That is language that's currently in statute. It's in the Senate language. It is not in the House language. Page R41, in the House, and starting at the bottom of page R40 in the Senate language, talks about the criteria for fuel switching, which I mentioned earlier. One thing that's very different in the House and Senate language is that, in order to be counted towards energy savings, fuel switching has to be deemed efficient. And the language sets out tests that determine whether it's efficient or not, and that language is the same in both the House and the Senate version. What's different is that at the top of page R41, it's the Commissioner of Commerce who is determining whether the fuel switching is efficient. And in the Senate, back on page R40, each consumer-owned utility is to form a technical working group to define and establish those programs and also to determine whether these fuel switching projects are efficient or not. Also on page R41 on the Senate side is the criteria for SIP solar rebates that now contribute to a utility's energy savings goal. And it says that the energy produced by a solar project that
a utility, consumer-owned utility contributes to would be counted toward energy savings. There is, however, no minimum amount of spending that's required for all those energy savings to be counted towards the utility's savings goal. Toward the bottom of the page, there's language about the utility's conservation improvement reports being filed electronically. It's a little bit different. The House says they must be filed electronically. The Senate is more flexible. It says if a consumer-owned utility is unable to do so, that's okay. And also other parties that send information regarding SIPs to the Department of Commerce can also file not electronically. Turning to page R42, Subdivision 10 in the House language and Subdivision 11 in the Senate language is entitled Assessment. The Commissioner of the Department assesses public utilities for work the department or the Commission does on behalf of all utilities. And there are the language in this subdivision talks to three separate assessments. One is in Section 216B.241. It's called Technical Assistance, which requires the Commissioner of Commerce to prepare an inventory of all those energy conservation improvements that utilities can use to meet their energy savings goal. Subdivision 1E, there's an assessment for what are called applied research and development grants, and that can be up to $3.6 million a year. This is an area where research is done on new technologies, new energy efficiency strategies, and other kinds of things to improve the effectiveness of the SIP program. And finally, Section 1F develops sustainable building guidelines for state-owned buildings. As you can see in the House language on line 278.32, this allows the Commissioner Department to assess utilities for each of those sections, for each of those purposes. On the Senate side, it's only Subdivision 1D that the Commissioner or Department can assess utilities. Paragraph B on lines 89, 16, 17, and 18 say that for the applied R&D grants and the sustainable building guidelines for state buildings, assessments can only be done by the Department or the Commission upon notice from the utility of the desire to continue the assessment. So it requires kind of an opt-in on the part of consumer-owned utilities to allow those assessments to occur. The language on the Senate side on R42 speaks to large customer facilities that can petition the commissioner essentially to be exempt from the SIP program, and as a result, the utility to which it which provides it with service does not have to count its revenues as part of the program. There's similar language on page R44 in the House, and this is also language that's currently in statute. There's one significant change. At the bottom of page R44 in the House language, it talks about a commercial gas customer that's not a large customer facility but can arrange or can ask for an exemption from the commissioner. Right now, the last line on that page, 280.24, says the natural gas public utility having fewer than 600,000 natural gas customers. That exempts CenterPoint, which has more than 600,000 customers. That language, as you can see, is in the House version. It's not in the Senate version, and it is in current statute. So that's another difference of these things. And that concludes the section, happily, I think, on consumer-owned utilities. Now we're going to go through the same issues for public utilities, because that is how this section is now organized. And the first thing I would draw your attention to at the bottom of page R45 is in the House language on line page 281, line 18, the energy savings goal has been increased from 1.5% to 1.75%. In the Senate, it remains at its current 1.5%. Another difference is that those energy utility infrastructure projects, the savings from that can be carried over for 3 years in the House, same as it is currently, but 5 years in the Senate. On page R46, this is generally similar language. Towards the bottom of the page, the House language requires public utilities to keep track of what they call lifetime energy savings and cumulative energy savings. When a conservation investment is made, it normally produces investments over a long period of time. And the House language is saying keep track of those as time wears on. Looking now at page R47, this is that section regarding an assessment for technical assistance that I mentioned. The difference here is in the amount of money on page 283, line 27 in the House language. The assessment is up to $850,000, and on the Senate side, 93.15, it's $450,000. You'll also notice that the language that's stricken at the bottom of the page was for using up to $400,000 of that assessment for the purpose of developing, operating, and maintaining a uniform electronic data reporting and tracking system for SIP. That language is stricken in both versions, but the $400,000 was subtracted from the $850,000 in the Senate version and not in the House version. At the bottom of the House language, again on page R47, it requires the Department of Commerce, the Commissioner of Commerce, to develop and publish technical information which will help utilities to evaluate whether those fuel switching programs we talked about before are indeed efficient or not. So that is something that the Department of Commerce has to come up with. On page R48, in the center of the page in the House language is just removal of some obsolete language for something that was supposed to be completed by the year 2010. Otherwise, language at the bottom of the page is similar in both houses, and that continues to be the case for page R49, talking about different programs under SIP. Again, at the top of page R50 in paragraph G in the House language, the Energy Conservation and Optimization Plan again requires public utilities to include activities to improve energy efficiency in schools, public schools that are served by the utility. That's not in the House language. Recovery of expenses in the middle of that page is similar in both houses. And the same thing is true of the new language the language at the bottom of the page regarding the ownership of an energy conservation improvement, which just treats pre-weatherization measures in the same manner as energy conservation improvements regarding ownership. On page R51, House-only language, this is language that I think has been in the statute since the mid-1980s. And on line page 288, line 2, as originally written, it was strongly encouraging the use of fluorescent and high-intensity discharge lamps. The House strikes that language and inserts LED lamps as something that utilities should strongly encourage the use of in their conservation improvement activities. Turning to page R52, we have very similar language with respect to low-income programs for public utilities. Few word differences, and that continues on page R53. Both the House and the Senate language make provisions for multifamily low-income housing to be the subject of low-income programs in public utilities, and they do that through identical language on that page. The next House-only provision is in the middle of page R54. But the change is actually in the middle of page R55. It allows the Center for the Sustainable Building Research at the University of Minnesota, which receives up to $500,000, to use up to $150,000 of that to provide technical assistance to local jurisdictions that adopt a voluntary stretch building code, which I'll talk about a little later when we come to that language. On page R56, towards the bottom, is house-only language that talks about the department approving efficient fuel switching improvements and requires those fuel switching improvements to meet certain requirements that are on page R57. These are the same requirements that we saw with respect to consumer-owned utilities, but this language is not in the Senate version, in the Senate language that applies to public utilities. On page R58, the House language adds some new definitions to the Integrated Resource Plan section of the statutes. Paragraph F on 296.12 defines clean energy resources. Paragraph G defines carbon-free resources. The language at the bottom of page R58, defining energy storage systems, is pretty similar in both the House and the Senate. And on R59, towards the middle of the page, there's some house-only definitions of local job impacts and local workers. Now it comes to some additional house-only language regarding integrated resource plans. It begins at the bottom of page R59. Let me point out on page R60, towards the top of the page, section 32, environmental costs, specifies that environmental cost values that the Public Utilities Commission has adopted for different ways of generating electricity. This specifies that when the Commission considers those costs, they have to use non-zero values, and they should also include both the low and high values of the cost range that they have adopted. Section 33, towards the bottom of the page, establishes that it's state policy that the favored method to meet electricity demand in Minnesota is a combination of clean energy resources. Section 34 presents the kind of analysis that is required in an integrated resource plan that's proposing a non-renewable energy facility. The substance of it is on the top of page R61. It must include a plan to meet 50, 75, and 100% of the energy from clean energy and carbon-free resources. Section 35, in the middle of that page, also speaks to the standard the Commission must use in evaluating whether non-renewable energy sources should be selected. Requires on page 299, line 18, that the utility demonstrate by clear and convincing evidence that a renewable energy facility alone or in combination with other clean energy sources is not in the public interest. And at the very bottom of that page, it says to find a renewable energy facility not in the public interest, the Commission must determine that it is, at the top of page R62, either not affordable or not reliable. And the rest of the language on page R62 goes into greater detail as to how those conditions can be met. Paragraph F on page R62, beginning on 300, line 22, requires the Commission to make a written determination of its findings and conclusions in an integrated resource planning process. On page R63, in the middle of the page, section 36 is more house-only language, requiring that as part of the resource plan filing, the utility report on local job impacts and any steps the utility and its energy suppliers and contractors are taking to maximize the availability of local construction employment. Section 37 at the bottom of that page says if a utility is selecting resources through a bidding process that utility also consider local job impacts? On page R64, at the top, there is language, there is identical language in both the House and the Senate requiring that in an integrated resource plan, energy storage systems be assessed as possibilities for providing energy. Then we come down to section 39 on page R64 with some more House-only language requiring the utilities report annually an ancillary services cost report to the Public Utilities Commission. Ancillary services are essentially reliability-type services that utilities must either purchase or provide by themselves to keep the energy system reliable. One of the benefits of energy storage, possibly, is to reduce the costs of those. But since we don't know exactly what the costs of those are, this language requires those costs to be reported annually by utilities. On page R65, now we're into the Certificate of Need statute, and what this language on this page does is require that when evaluating a Certificate of Need, energy storage also be considered as meeting some or all of the proposed energy needs. And on page R66, additional House language at the bottom of the page. Commission must not issue a certificate of need for non-renewable resource, again, unless it's been demonstrated by clear and convincing evidence that clean energy sources are not... Excuse me. Oh, that they've done the analysis that's required of which we discussed earlier. You have one.
Thank you, Mr. Eloff. Let you catch your breath for a minute.
Thank you.
On the bottom of page R66, there's a Senate-only provision, Section 6. This would abolish the prohibition for the Public Utilities Commission to issue a certificate of need for new construction of nuclear power plants.
And on page R63, there's two sections dealing with beneficial electrification. Section 42 says it's the goal of the state to promote energy and uses powered by electricity that reduce greenhouse gases and improve public health. And Section 43 allows utilities to submit to the Commission a plan to promote energy end uses powered by electricity within its service area, and the Commission will analyze and approve, reject, or modify those plans. At the top of page R68 also says those plans can or cost recovery is obtainable under those plans. Section 44 on page R68 requires utilities to establish a workplace supplier diversity policy that establishes goals and efforts the utility is making to increase workplace and supplier diversity. Towards the bottom of that page, in Section 1, is House-only language that revives and reenacts an assessment that was sunsetted as of June 30th, 2018, that allows the Public Utilities Commission to represent the state in regional regional and national bodies that deal with energy implementation, the implementation of energy policy or regulation. And at the top of R69, we have language that is very similar in both the House and the Senate version of the Solar for Schools program regarding the schools that are located outside the XL service territory. The one major difference is that the House definition of solar energy system includes energy storage systems. And On page R72, we've got similar language regarding solar for schools within Xcel's service territory, and that same difference of the house including energy storage systems is present in that language as well. Otherwise, it's I believe it's identical language. At the bottom of page R74 is section 46 in the house language, providing for a program to award rebates to purchasers of electric vehicles, $2,500 for new electric vehicles and $500 for used electric vehicles. On page R76, section 47 of the House language is a program to award grants for electric vehicle public charging. Again, this section is for locations within Xcel electric service territory, and chargers are to be directed also towards park and ride facilities and state and regional parks and trailheads. On page R77, a very similar program that applies to areas located outside of Xcel territory.
On the Senate side, on page R77, section 8, this is the Senate proposal for an electric vehicle charging station revolving loan program. And this is within Xcel territory. You'll see that the funding mechanism is on, let's see, I thought it was within the statute, but it is coming from the RDA, and all of the Senate programs that are coming from the RDA are applicable to Xcel territory. The maximum amount for this would be for public use, for charging stations for public use. On page R79, the maximum loan amount for an electric vehicle charging station would be $30,000. And I think that there are other specifications regarding the loan program, but it would be a revolving loan fund. That money would go back into the loan fund for use for other charging, electric vehicle charging stations.
On page R80 and R81 is identical language in both the House and Senate regarding the property assessed clean energy program for commercial buildings that has the effect of including new construction as being eligible for treatment under the PACE program. And at the bottom of page R81 is House only language requiring the Commissioner of Commerce to coordinate with both labor and industry and DEED to develop plans and programs to mitigate the impacts on local communities and workers when large electric generation facilities retire. On page R82, section 53 is house-only language that allows the Public Utilities Commission in awarding a permit for a large wind system to require contractors and subcontractors to pay prevailing wage rate, and that also applies to modifying site permits for wind repowering projects. Section 54 extends the same ability for counties that have assumed permit authority for wind projects. And section 55 on page R83 says the legislature finds and declares that greenhouse gas emissions resulting from human activities are a key cause of climate change. Section 56 on that page is something I referred to earlier. It requires the Construction Codes Advisory Council to establish a voluntary code of standards that conforms to Sustainable Building 2030 standards, which is actually part of the SIP program and requires building standards that go way beyond the state building code. This would allow that alternative voluntary code of standards to be adopted by local jurisdictions.
On page R83, we have actually two, there are going to be two sections that are regarding, one is regarding damage to pipelines, and in section 11, that would add a new felony for a person who alters the equipment or physical operations of a pipeline with intent to disrupt services and without consent. That on page R84, it does specifically state that it does not apply to activities related to labor disputes. Section 12, this applies to trespass on critical public service facility or pipeline, and it provides that a person who enters the site or work site of a critical public service facility with the intent to disrupt the operation is guilty of a 5-year felony. And the same exclusion is there regarding any activities related to a labor dispute. That's on page R86. On page R87, we have two, section 13 and section 14. This merely is some cleanup from 2017 session law that is deleting references to an account that never existed and now references the renewable development account.
Members, I'd also point out that identical language to sections 13 and 14 is in House File 1798, which is on the House, or is awaiting. It's on the General Register, actually. And on page R88 at the bottom is House only language requiring the Department of Commerce to develop and send to the Public Utilities Commission a financial incentive designed to encourage public utilities to continue investing in cost-effective conservation measures for residential consumers after the system-wide 1.75% energy savings goal has been met, or 1.2% for gas energy savings goal. Section 5 on page R89 is a study that will be done at the University of Minnesota to produce climate change model projections for the entire state of Minnesota in blocks as small as 3 square miles. Those projections would be for the rest of this century. On page R90 is House-only language that appropriates money to the Metropolitan Council to pay the difference between fossil fuel-fueled buses and electric buses. And Section 58 also contains or provides money for a grant to demonstrate an electric school bus. And that extends to page 92. Section 59 requires Commissioner of Commerce to develop benchmarks and strategies designed to significantly accelerate reduction of greenhouse gas emissions and lists a number of strategies that should be analyzed in order for that to happen.
On page R92, we have section 60 on the House side and section 9 on the Senate side. There are quite a few similarities, but a few differences. This is for what the Senate calls the Prairie Island Net Zero Project. The House calls it the Prairie Island Renewable Energy, but the purposes would basically be the same. There is a little bit more of a description on the House side of where the renewable energy projects should take place. The Senate does not provide that information. Then in Subdivision 3, the House requires a report. The Senate requires that the Prairie Island Indian Community file a plan with deed and then file a report. And I believe that the House side just requires the report to be submitted.
At the bottom of page R93, there's House-only language that requires utilities to participate in a study which will examine that once large electric generation resources are retired, what kinds of transmission network enhancements are necessary to maintain system reliability. I believe that's funded at $1 million. Turning to page R94, in the middle of the page, Section 62 is House-only language, requiring the Public Utilities Commission to convene a stakeholder group to examine challenges and opportunities for Minnesota's energy utilities to attract a diverse workforce. It sets out the requirements of what the stakeholder group must do.
On the bottom of page R94, Section 15 on the Senate side, this provision would prohibit the Department of Commerce from using any appropriations on the Line 3 appeal. Section 16 on page R95, this is a section that was added on the Senate floor, and it would request the Legislative Energy Commission to examine the opportunities and challenges of increasing either the renewable energy standard or the state's greenhouse gas emissions reduction goals, and then request the LEC to complete its examination and any recommendations by January 15th of 2020. This is similar to what was done for the propane strategies a few years back when there was the polar vortex. On page R95, we have two sections that establish a biomass business compensation and account. This establishes a claims process for businesses that were affected by the closure of the Benson biomass plant a couple of years ago, and would be administered by the Office of Administrative Hearings, and sets up the criteria and eligibility for the claims and awarding claims and the deadlines as well. On page R98, then, in section 11, the biomass business compensation account is established, and that would be in subdivision 2 on 123.9, $40 million from on July 1st, 2019 would be transferred for the purpose of the biomass business compensation. This would be from the renewable development account. On page R98, section 12, this is the Green Roof Advisory Task Force and report. This would set up the task force, and then it provides for membership of the task force. That's on page R99, who would be included in that group, and then would require a report by March 1st of 2020 from the findings of the task force. On page R100, section 13, this is on the Senate. This is part of the energy storage package. This would require the Commissioner of Commerce to contract with an independent consultant to study or to analyze and provide a report on the potential costs and benefits of energy storage systems.
And on page R100 and R101 are a list of appropriations for some of the sections that we've already discussed, which will probably be gone over during the fiscal part of this run through. So that brings us to page R104 and the repealers, which in the House version are in paragraph A, those are sections of the SIP statute, subdivision 1 being the definitions, which are largely repeated in the language here. Section 2C is an obsolete provision that required something to be done in 2008. Same thing with subdivision 4. Paragraph B of the repealer in the House is the $500,000 for the third-party evaluator in the case there's a grant cycle under the RDA that's repealed and that money is used elsewhere.
As Mr. Eluff mentioned, there are a number of appropriations for the RDA, but I think Mr. Mum will go through that when he does the spreadsheet. Then the one repealer we have on page R105, section 8, this would repeal the current SIP statute for the co-ops, or the section applicable to the co-ops and munis for the SIP program. And that concludes the walkthrough of the side-by-sides.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, we can't hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry. And I do have a soft voice, and he will push me all the time.
Just look at the mic right now.
Look at the mic. Okay. Senator Pat, did you have a question?
No, Madam Chair. Would you?
Oh.
I didn't vote on our own new building. We just couldn't hear what you were saying.
Oh. Well, we will now go over the fiscal part.
Madam Chair, representatives, my name is, and senators, excuse me. My name is Solveig Beckel, and I'm the House Fiscal Analyst for this committee.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Casey Mum. I'm the Fiscal Analyst from the Senate. If you turn to page 8 of the spreadsheet, it's where the appropriations pertinent to energy, utilities, and climate begin. Starting on line 361, shows the appropriations to the Public Utilities Commission. Both the House and the Senate contained the same amounts, and both positions reflect a $300,000 per year increase for the base operating expenses of the commission. That's to fund two new FTEs to handle upcoming rate cases. Because the commission has assessment authority to recover those expenses, there's an associated revenue on line 365 to offset the increased cost of the two FTEs. On page 9, is the Department of Commerce's appropriations. There are two divisions in the Senate that are relevant. That's the Energy Resources Division and the Telecommunications Division. In the House, I believe the Telecommunications Division is under the Jobs and Economic Development Committee's jurisdiction. There's a change on line 378. The House position funds increased operating costs for the department. I believe that was a governor's budget request. Then there are a number of House-only provisions on line 379 through 385.
Yes, so going over those provisions, the House bill appropriates money for the North Dakota litigation costs. It also provides funding for the carbon sequestration evaluation, the solar on schools grants, and that is specifically for schools outside of the Xcel Energy operating zone. It also provides funding for the things Mr. Eloff mentioned, such as the SIP financial incentives, the U of M climate study, the storage systems cost benefit, and then some electric vehicle charging station grants, again, for charging stations outside of the Xcel area.
Both the on line 386 and 387, both the House and the Senate contained the same appropriations for the State Energy Office and a program to remediate asbestos in low-income households. On line 390 is the appropriation to the Petroleum Tank Release Compensation Board. That is the same in both the House and the Senate position. Those are base funding amounts from the Petroleum Release Fund, Petroleum Tank Fund. On line 392 through 403 is the Commerce Telecommunications Division. Both the House and the Senate contain the same position with one exception, and that's on line 394. The House funds an increased operating cost request that was contained in the governor's budget, and the Senate does not. And on line 396, both the House and the Senate contain an increased appropriation to the Commission of Deaf, Blind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. That's an increase of $900,000 over the biennium. That's from the Telecommunications Access Minnesota Fund. If you turn to page 10, on line 554 begins a few revenue changes.
I can speak to this. So line 454, like Mr. Mum said, is the information on the utility grid reliability assessment extension revenue. You can see right below it is the expenditures. We have this listed separately because it is not out of the general fund. It's out of the special revenue fund. And the House differs from the Senate in this, as the House reestablished that assessment where the Senate did not. So you can see the expenditures and then the assessments to have that revenue come back. The other ones are in the jobs area of the bill, except for the SIP financial incentives. You can see the revenue comes back from that as well.
And on lines 458, 459 are revenue changes to reflect the reduction in the amount that the Department of Commerce can assess for the energy and conservation account. And this is to reflect an expired paragraph that had a $400,000 a year spending authority attached to it. The next changes are on the last page, page 12, and they begin at the top, and these are changes made from the renewable development account funding. So everything from lines 492 to 523 reflect the different renewable development account spending positions in each body. On line 492 is the cap that is contained in the Senate bill. Rather than a per cask fee that exists in current law, the Senate bill changes the amount that Xcel Energy pays into the renewable development account to a fixed amount per year. Results in reductions to renewable development account revenue compared to the forecast of $1 million in fiscal 20, $3 million in fiscal year 21, and then over the course of the next biennium, the cap is reduced to $20,000 per year, or I'm sorry, $20 million per year, resulting in a reduction of $32 million over the fiscal year 22 and 23 biennium. On line 495 is a Senate-only provision that allows Xcel Energy to withhold $125,000 a year from the amount transferred to the renewable development account, and this is to provide a third-party evaluator for the Solar Awards program. Currently, this amount is directly appropriated, or was directly appropriated in the 2017 bill. And that's for the same purpose.
So the next line down shows the House changes to future amounts that would be in the renewable development account. This reflects continuing the Xcel Solar Awards program and increasing it. So an additional $4 million would be withheld in fiscal year 20, an additional $9 million in 21, and an additional $5 million in 22. Now, that portion of the bill also discussed increasing the amount to be spent on solar awards in 2019, so you can see a $5 million appropriation farther down the sheet on line 518, and that is also related to that solar rewards program. Skipping down then, we have the Prairie Island Net Zero grants to DEED. The House and Senate differ considerably with their appropriations. The House appropriates $5 million over the biennium, and the Senate appropriates $27.5 million over the biennium. Then I believe Mr. Mum can continue.
The Prairie Island Net Zero appropriation also contains $15 million over the 22-23 biennium in the Senate position, and $3.7 million appropriation in fiscal year 24, and that brings the total over the 5 years to $46.2 million. On lines 498 and 499 are the transfers that Ms. Carlin referred to with the biomass business compensation account. It's $40 million transferred in fiscal year 20 and $200,000 transferred in fiscal year 20 as well. On line 500 is the appropriation for the host communities economic development program to allow communities to who are facing a potential plant closure to begin preparing for that transition.
Then on line 501, we start with the other House RDA appropriations. So there is an appropriation of $8 million for electric buses. Then the U of M renewable energy transition. For the U of M in the metro area, that's $6 million. And then the MN State buildings that are still within the XL area are appropriated an additional $6 million. The DNR would receive $3.5 million for solar devices in state parks. Schools within the XL Energy operating area would receive $16 million for the Solar on Schools program. The Senate also has a program for that where they appropriate $2 million over the biennium. Then both bills have provisions for storage studies, but the Senate's is somewhat different.
Yeah, the Senate makes a direct appropriation in fiscal year 19 of $150,000 one time. On lines 508 and 509 are appropriations for the Green Roof Task Force and the Electric Vehicle Charging Station Revolving Loan Fund. Those are appropriations in fiscal year 20 of $55,000 and $1.5 million, respectively. Both are one-time only appropriations.
On line 510, you can see the administrative appropriations for the Made in Minnesota program. And then 511 shows that the House bill gets rid of the third-party evaluator provision. The next line down, let's see, starting 512 is the $750 million a year appropriation, so $750,000. significant difference there. Is the $1.5 million over the biennium for Commerce to administer the community solar program. An additional $2 million for the Community Solar LIHEAP program, or low-income program. $10.4 million for electric vehicle purchase rebates. $2.5 million for electric vehicle charging stations. $100,000 for the building stretch code transition. And $1 million for the electric transmission study, and I already mentioned that $5 million for the transfer back to Excel. And then the last line there you can see is the governor's recommendation for renewable and energy efficiency grants.
And lastly, on lines 522 and 523 are subtotals. Line 522 shows the total spending from the renewable development account in the various articles in each bill. And line 523 shows the estimated balance in the renewable development account after those changes relative to the February forecast. I would note that the totals do not make changes in the assumed amount of investment income that would be deposited in the renewable development account. It just takes the forecasted numbers and assumes that they will continue. Of course, the actual investment income amount would vary depending on the actual balance in the account. So that's noted in the parentheses on that line. And that concludes the energy portion of the spreadsheet.
Questions from members? I don't see any. Thank you all for doing that. Appreciate it. So we can go to the next part of the work we have to do. And what I have picked out in our bill are some technical things that look technical to me. May not look technical to you, but I see three provisions like that. And maybe a half dozen same provisions, and I would suggest that we go ahead and adopt those, go through them and adopt those, and then we can move on to other things. But from the House's point of view, we have to get the policy worked out, and obviously, there's lots to do there, but we have to get the policy worked out before we can go into appropriations. But if you all are ready, just start working on the technicals. And what I would assume we do, if we are not in agreement, we will just set something aside, and we can just set things aside. We don't have to. Let's see what we can do to come together today and. Let's go that way. Senator Pratt.
Madam Chair. What I'd like to do is just take about 10 minutes for the Senate to caucus what you just discussed, if you don't mind.
Oh, that's perfectly fine. 10-minute recess?
We'll take a 10-minute recess. Senate, there's the old SOB offices right over there. Maybe we can just... gather in that area, and we'll be back at 3:10.
That works for us. We will be in recess. 10 minutes.
What is that? That's how you call the governor. It's a, land, it's a straight line of gov. Calls the revisor.
There wasn't. That's my best guess. Oh, so it's
What are we going to be doing? Yes. We'll find out, huh?
No, we never
We will reconvene, and as folks have noticed, some of us have been in the hall discussing about what we're going to do to go forward. And the House is prepared to discuss a number of issues. We had planned a full afternoon and a full evening. We were prepared to talk about storage, where we have and PACE, where we have the same provisions. We're prepared to talk about five reports that are in the bill, just so we can get discussions started. We were prepared to talk about our innovation in the bill and optimization policy goal, beneficial electrification. We're prepared to talk about all these things, our differences in SIP, our differences in community solar. But at this point, the Senate is unwilling to go forward, and I think it would be best if I don't put words into the Senate's mouth, and so I would yield to Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, following our typical custom and usage, we would like to finish walking. Well, first of all, since we got many of these provisions this morning, and since we've typically we'll walk through an entire comparison before we start adopting same and similars, I've talked to our members. We'd like to take some time to look at the differences in the bill, to look at the technical comparisons that your staff has put together, and be ready to come back for a full and robust conversation that's thoughtful and not just react to what we see on the pages. And so that's where we're at here in the Senate, and I'm sure we can get through a good chunk. We can finish the rest of the bill tomorrow. We can work with Chair Mahoney to figure out the schedule for the rest of the week, and we'd be happy to again collaborate with the House in making sure that this committee works smoothly.
Are there any comments by members? on your side. And then with that, we are adjourned.
Madam Chair, before we adjourn, I'd just like to, it'll be posted very soon, but we will expect to meet in this same room tomorrow at 12:30, same time. We'll jump into at least the rest of the bill, and the chair and I will discuss how much farther we're comfortable going after that point. So for those that are watching the postings, be a little bit flexible as we continue to do our coordination.
Thank you, Chair Wagenius. I hope we don't inconvenience people with this short notice for tomorrow's at what time? 3:30?
12:30.
12:30. I certainly hope that we can turn around this committee. We don't seem to be getting far at all, and I think we are casting aspirations at each other, and that really needs to stop. Otherwise, this bill will likely get taken away from us, and leadership will do it. And I certainly hope, I know I don't want that. I certainly see that happening at this particular point. But with that, 3:30 or 12:30 tomorrow, I guess we'll do the walkthrough. Hopefully we will be we'll be more ready to work tomorrow. So with that, members, I'm done.